welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. Paul Kelly is a researcher and lecturer in physical activity at Edinburgh University. Working with Paths for All, the Scottish charity promoting walking and cycling, he's been investigating the measures that facilitate or obstruct people from walking more. Recently, he's been reviewing, from a public health standpoint, the introduction of a blanket 20-mile-an-hour restriction on motorists across Edinburgh, comparing it with other cities. We're on a brisk walk early in February in Prince's Gardens in Edinburgh, seeking quiet places away from the nearby railway, commuter traffic, and a contractor mowing the lawns. We're walking through Prince's Gardens, is that right there?
Absolutely, yeah, centre of Edinburgh.
In the centre of Edinburgh. And you've been working in Scotland for, what, half a dozen years?
Yeah, it'll be, 6 years in the summer.
Would you like to try and tell a listener a little bit about why you're here and what you get up to?
So I am a physical activity researcher, lecturer in physical activity for health. So half my job is conducting research in and around physical activity promotion, and the other half is teaching students, and that includes PE teachers, trainee doctors, sports scientists, and MSc students. I'm in a physical activity for health research centre. It's led by Professor Nanette Moutry. And we do have a focus on active travel, I'd say, as kind of one of the primary physical activities that we're most interested in.
Okay, and what you haven't mentioned is that you also have another hat.
Yes, my other hat is I'm a director at Paths for All. Paths for All are a Scottish charity that promote primarily walking, but walking and cycling for everyone in Scotland. So it's about making it accessible and protecting and improving routes and access and information and knowledge, and also helping, you know, deliver some of the programmes, health walks, active travel promotion, that sort of thing, the length and breadth of Scotland.
Now, but is it a complete myth that in Scotland you can roam anywhere?
You would need to speak to a lawyer to get the... I wouldn't want to put anyone in a bad situation. I know that it's kind of commonly called right to roam, although actually the bill or the piece of law legislation might be called the public access rights or something. I don't believe you can walk anywhere at any time with impunity. I think, you know, you obviously need to respect livestock, farms, people's private gardens, these sort of things. But yes, on average in Scotland, I believe there's far more access to, you know, the countryside, the highlands, the hills, the lochs. You know, and there is a responsibility for people who access those areas to respect them and leave them as they found them.
But there's no actual sort of network of rights of way.
I believe that's right. Yes, I mean there are marked paths. There's a number of fantastic long-distance paths in Scotland, West Highland Way, probably the most famous, but, you know, there's another 20, you know, and there are footpaths and signage, you know, if you get out into the countryside. But my understanding is legally it is different to England, yes.
Was Scotland starting from a low base when it came to, you know, walking for health or health walks? Or, you know, tell us a little bit about Scottish health in terms of physical activity in a sort of broad population way rather than knuckling you down yet onto your specific area of research.
It's a very timely question because actually a kind of team from Paths for All and Edinburgh University are looking at this exact question right now. A kind of obvious starting point is around about devolution. So we're sort of going back to the mid-90s for our starting point. And the kind of the headline is that physical activity prevalence, physical activity levels in Scotland have gone up about 4% since, you know, that time in the mid-90s. So two-thirds of people meet the definition of being active.
I mean, is that pretty good? I don't know.
There's two ways of looking at it. We could look at the positives, like you say, two-thirds of people basically active, and we could look at the good that's doing for them, psychologically, socially, physically. But, you know, the flip side of that coin is one in three people aren't being active enough, and there's very good evidence that they are going to be experiencing kind of health burdens and lower quality of life as a result of that. is it good or bad? You know, I don't think, you know, that one could make a absolute judgment on that. But I think the thing that we're looking at is, in contrast to trends in many places of the world, especially in Europe and Western Europe, Scotland has seen this 4% rise in the number of people being active. You know, and across a population of 5.5-6 million people, that's a decent number of people. So what we're trying to do is establish why that may have been. Can we find key policies or interventions or actions which have led to it? And, you know, our kind of analysis that's taking place at the moment suggests that it's walking might be one of the main things that have gone up to increase the overall levels of activity.
Let's talk a bit more about your own specific kind of areas of work. I know that you were a bit of a mischief maker when it came to your PhD. You actually revealed that most people make up stories about how active they are.
That would be one interpretation. Yes. So I started my PhD over 10 years ago now. And at the time, Microsoft Research had just created what they called SenseCam, which was a camera that you wore around your neck. It was about the size of a deck of playing cards, very lightweight. And, you know, you've got to go back 10, 12 years now to understand why this was impressive, but it had a battery life of about 18 hours, and it could store tens of thousands of images, which, you know, everyone's phone can do nowadays, but back then, that was pretty impressive. So they developed this device, and they were looking for applications. And the primary one they were working in at the time was memory, and especially people who have cognitive impairments. But we saw this device and thought, oh, we could use that to solve one of the big problems we have in physical activity research, which is knowing how much activity people are doing. Mm-hmm. Because there are well-established limitations of asking someone how much they do, asking them to remember it or to give a general perception. And similarly, there are big problems. You know, if I give you a device to wear, will you wear it?
Switch it on.
Will you switch it on? Is wearing it for 3 days, does that really give me a picture of what you're really like? Or do you just think, oh, I'm wearing a device, I better run around a bit more? So we thought, well, we've got this camera now, we can actually see what people are doing. So the whole PhD was, we asked about 300 people to wear the camera, and it took a photo every 15 seconds. And at the same time, we asked them to fill out a travel diary. So it's the main one that's used in England. It's the National Travel Survey. So, you know, it's very important in terms of informing policy and things like that. What we didn't do was tell people we were checking how well they were filling in the diary. We told them, you know, the photos were just going to give us more information. And then I sat down. It took about 3 months. I looked at over 3 million images and said, aha, at 10 o'clock on Tuesday, you left the house and you jumped on your bike. At 10:20, you arrived at the shops. Let's see what you said in the diary. And some people would write 20 minutes, you know, as they were spot on. Other people would write 60 minutes, so they'd hugely exaggerated. Other people would write 5 minutes, because either they'd enjoyed it so much, or they were in a rush. And other people would forget to put it there entirely.
Yeah, yeah.
So the implication from the whole PhD in the end was, there's a huge random variation in what people will put for a single given journey or bout or walk compared to what, if you were watching them, you'd actually see. However, interestingly, this variation cancelled itself out. So if you ask 300 people how much walking do you do, and they say, on average, 27 minutes a day, that's going to be about right. Within about 80 seconds, which is more than good enough for doing the science and the research and the policy. So it meant this self-report behaviour is very, very good when looking at large groups, but it's probably not going to work if you need to detect how much an individual has changed. For example, if you're doing a one-to-one intervention or a group of 100 people, something like that, then we need to find better ways of detecting that change. So, yeah, that was the PhD. I don't know how much mischief it created, but it certainly was really interesting in learning about how people perceive and understand their own walking and cycling.
And it's true that men lie more than women?
That wasn't true. That was one of our hypotheses. We thought there'd be a difference by male or female, or by car drivers versus cyclists, or by people who worked in offices versus people who were going to university, whatever it might be. But it wasn't that some people are over-reporters and some people under-reporters. It's that in a given day, if you did a diary, your first journey might be a huge over-report, your second might be a huge under-report, and you might forget about the third. So that random variation seemed to be spread entirely evenly throughout our population.
I think I came across you when you had done a research. I'm not sure whether it was particularly for Pulse for All, but it was around looking at the obstacles that might get in the way of people walking or cycling more. Was that right?
Well, there was a piece of research just before Christmas. It was a piece of research that was commissioned by Paths for All and Ramblers Scotland jointly. And they wanted to know what were the barriers and facilitators of recreational walking in Scotland, in the Scottish population.
Especially pertinent, because on the tube at the moment we have advertisements with a picture of someone looking over the moors or the lochs or the coast of Scotland or something and saying, look how big your garden can be if you come to work here. So all this fantastic right to roam countryside, are people going out to enjoy it?
Well, some people are. It does seem to be socially stratified, so people from wealthier parts of Scotland seem to do it more often than people from the less wealthy areas, which is, you know, something that Ramblers Scotland and Paths for All would like to try and start addressing. I presume the advert was a kind of Scottish tourist board.
I think it was, and actually move your work. It's an advertisement to businesses to move their all their staff to Scotland what a fantastic place to work and live. But let's not talk about the advert. Let's talk about your research. Tell us a little bit more about what the research revealed.
Well, we'll come back to the advert, because actually it was one of the research findings, which was what sort of information persuades people or encourages people or supports people to do more recreational walking, you know, by which we mean going out for leisure, enjoying the countryside, enjoying the outdoors, that sort of thing. And by and large, we kind of focus on what one might consider a health-based model, where we talk about cardiovascular risk or diabetes or honestly the sort of things that don't really determine people's day-to-day behaviours and choices. So it's really interesting to see, you know, how, for example, Scottish Business or the Tourist Board understand this and actually are appealing to people's emotions and showing, you know, images of vast expanses and beautiful scenery, which, you know, obviously Scotland does have, as the kind of hook or tool to try and persuade, nudge or shift people's behaviour. It's research that we're now doing in physical activity and in walking is, you know, what's the best information? What's the best messaging approach? What are our effective communication approaches? And it's probably not a kind of medical based model. So yeah, that was one of the findings from the work we did on facilitators and barriers. We sort of organised them, but so that was, you know, individual level factors, you know, people's personal knowledge and motivations, social factors, so who do they know, who do they talk to, who do they do things together with, environmental factors, so how close is it, is there a bus route, is there parking, which is a kind of interesting component of the issue. How good is the quality of path when they get there? Is it accessible for people who maybe have challenges with balance or with stamina or something like that? And then, of course, at the top level, what are the policy factors? So as you mentioned, you know, the right to roam or the Scottish access rights. Our job was to summarise what was in the existing literature. So it's, you know, classic approach, the evidence reviewed. We found these 12 factors that seem to be important, either barriers or facilitators to recreational walking. And, you know, Ramblers Scotland are now going to be reflecting on those and trying to, you know, figure out which ones are strategic opportunities or can help guide action moving forward. There was an awful lot there about what information you get to people, how you get it to them, and what's most supportive. Because, you know, it might be that for one person, it's that picture of, you know, the beautiful Scottish landscape. For someone else, it might be information that walking 30 minutes a week in the outdoors is incredibly good for mental well-being. For someone else, that greenery reduces stress. For someone else, did you know that there's a lovely walking area just 10 minutes from your front door and there's a bus that goes straight there, or that sort of thing? There's a ton of work to be done about this understanding of what information to get to people and how to get it to them.
Okay, so that's all leisure walking. You know, I mean, you're talking about the research centre itself does a lot around active travel. Edinburgh's a great walking city. You know, my knowledge of other towns and cities in Scotland is pretty limited. So do people walk a lot for active travel? Is walking a significant leg in every commuting journey or every shopping errand? Or
Edinburgh is very good for walking.
You get plenty of exercise.
Tons.
Because, you know, this business about, you know, you have to be short of breath. It's not difficult climbing up and down stairways and alleyways.
Everywhere
and
seems to be uphill,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yes. Cobbled streets. You know, there's no shortage of shortness of breath.
My wife's Canadian, and when we moved together to Edinburgh almost 6 years ago, for about the first year, she was convinced that everywhere was uphill, wherever you tried to get to, and was into the wind. Seemed absolutely convinced by this fact. But so I agree. But that's, you know, like you say, it's a good thing. It's a city that keeps you active, keeps you healthy. And I've seen other work that suggests that's to do with the housing density. So there's not tons and tons of high rise, but there's lots and lots of these kind of townhouses with three or four apartments. There's a very, very good bus network. It encourages people not to drive, and there's not really anywhere to park, which also encourages people not to drive. So I think, taking the UK as a whole, Edinburgh is a very walkable place, and walking makes a good contribution to what people here do.
Getting people to be more active, you're obviously looking at those kinds of opportunity. What's your main focus of research at the moment? Let's put it that way.
You're absolutely right. We have a focus on walking and cycling, but primarily walking. The reason for that is there's a few factors, but we believe it's the primary way, the most accessible way, that across the population people can be active. You know, to take an example, what we don't think is that everyone should go to the gym every single day, because some people go and they love it, but most people don't. You know, similarly, some people want to be on a football team or a netball team or a rugby team. But if you look at a population, that's minority. That's not the majority. However, when you take an activity like walking, it's probably the thing that most people can do. Now, obviously, there are some people who have physical disabilities or functional impairments that prevent that. But by and large, the thing that most people can do, and I'm talking into the high 90%, is walking. And, you know, we've done research in Scotland. A colleague of mine, Tessa Strain, showed that if you look at how people in Scotland get their activity, the thing that is the most consistent contributor across both sex and age is walking. So if you look at sport, yes, men who are 16 to 24 do a bit. Not tons, they do a bit, but it's basically disappeared by their mid-30s, and the trend is even starker in women. Cycling, quite a small contribution. Things like what we might term exercise and fitness, so that's going to the gym, going swimming, going jogging. It's there, but it tails off with age. But walking makes this consistent contribution right up into the oldest age groups in Scotland. So this is, for us, a really important piece of evidence to support walking promotion as the primary way of helping people in Scotland, supporting people in Scotland to be more active. And we've had tremendous, you know, kind of changes, like we say, over the last 25 years or so in Scotland. You know, policy has started to recognise that it isn't about promoting sport. You know, it's about promoting walking, active travel, cycling, these sort of things. And long before I was here, you know, the work of people like Partaroll, Ramblers Scotland, Sustrans Scotland has really started to reflect this shift. And like I say, we think we're starting to nudge the needle in Scotland, and we think it's through increased walking.
And you're also involved, aren't you, in a big piece of public health research around the introduction of 20-mile-an-hour speed limits across Edinburgh?
Yes, that's right. The piece of research we're doing at the moment...
And you're looking at it from a physical activity point of view?
From a public health point of view. As you may be aware, in 2016, the 20-mile-an-hour speed limit intervention got rolled out across the city. And as these are a reasonably new policy area, or at least in terms of exploring the effects of them, we initiated this citywide study to try and understand what happens if you implement 20 mile an hour. And we're doing it in collaboration with colleagues from around the country, but also specifically in Belfast, where they did something similar a couple of years before. We're looking at the whole chain of events. So historically, how did the council, how did the city get to the point that they chose to implement that policy, you know, whereas other places haven't? done so yet? And then secondly, once implemented, what happens? We're almost 3 years into that project now. The evidence so far is very suggestive that speeds have gone down and that collisions have gone down. Now, there is a secular trend in the UK for collisions and injuries to be going down anyway. So what we're trying to disentangle at the moment is how much, if any, of the reduction in collisions and injuries can be attributed to the reduction in speeds. And much cleverer statisticians than me are currently trying to disentangle that. And likewise, we've got the follow-up perceptions data on people. We asked them before and after the intervention came in, and we'll soon know, do they feel safer? Does it feel more pleasant where they live, or not? The drivers feel that it's made a difference. Has it just frustrated them, or actually, are they more than happy to drive at 20? You know, there's some suggestion that you still get from A to B just as quickly because the traffic flows more efficiently, rather than all this stop, start, and acceleration. So it's a really interesting piece of work, huge team, and I think by the end of the year we'll have our findings in the public domain, which hopefully will support future decisions on whether or not to bring 20 mile an hour into an area.
Would you like to suggest a couple of walks that people might try?
If you're visiting Edinburgh, I strongly recommend walking to or up or around Arthur's Seat, depending on the weather and your desire to get to the top. But it's absolutely fantastic. It's wonderful. You can see the city, and I couldn't recommend it highly enough. Okay, so conceptually, some walks which I'd like to suggest or recommend. Firstly, if you're able to find any way of walking to and from work or school or university or the shops, i.e. effectively building in active travel, it's just a really nice way of getting some fresh air, getting some activity, and feeling these immediate mood and stress benefits. So strongly recommend that to anyone who's not tried it, but who's maybe tempted to after listening to this. I'd really recommend walking with someone, so going for a walk with a friend, a family member, or a colleague at work if there's something to discuss, and taking that opportunity to really enjoy that social time in a way that I personally just think is more enjoyable than being stuck in a chair or an office. The final one, if you have the opportunity, the evidence is also suggesting that it's not just greenery, but blue space that is good for well-being and these kind of human basic needs that seem to be ticked by being by it. So if you have the opportunity to walk alongside a riverbank or the sea, or my personal favourite, a canal, I'd recommend giving that a try.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Paul Kelly. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we'd love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded, and produced by Andrew Stark of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.